Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, taxes and the Fed. Fed being the central bank, Federal Reserve. What do they have in common? Well, we got this big tax cut here almost wrapped up. Probably the final pieces this weekend. $4.5 trillion in tax cuts for businesses and investors and their corporations, paid for by $3 trillion in tax hikes on the middle class, leaving a deficit of 1.5 or 1.4 trillion, depending who you want to talk to. Okay, and we have the Fed, Federal Reserve, made its decision here a couple of days ago on its tax, interest rate policy to raise interest rates a token amount once again, but said nothing, absolutely nothing about selling off its balance sheet of $4.5 trillion. As I've said before, that's all just talk. There's no real sell-off going to occur. Because if they do, it will accelerate interest rates to the stratosphere and quickly cut off this already weak economy. We hear a lot about how the economy is doing so well. Well, if you look behind the curtain, it's not so well. It's the calm before the storm in the real economy, and the storm is brewing on the financial side, as we've been talking about. Bubbles in stock markets, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency bubbles, junk bond bubbles, emerging market debt bubbles, leverage loan bubbles. And eventually, the financial bubbles will take precedence, and you'll see a rollback of the real economy, as I've been predicting, somewhere near the end of next year, 18, early 19. I think this is going to happen. So 2019 looks increasingly likely for a recession here in the U.S. and probably globally. Okay, so we have two big events this past week or on the way in the case of the tax cuts, $4.5 trillion subsidy to corporations, non-corporate businesses, and the wealthy 1% households, the investors who own the corporations and the businesses and who arrange to get the profits and wealth created by the corporations and businesses distributed to them personally. So you can't separate the 1% from their institutions, because they own them, they run them, they control them. It's theirs. That's how they generate their wealth. So we have the tax cut, $4.5 trillion. And as we've been saying in previous weeks, and as I spell out in great detail in my recent book a couple months ago, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, the Federal Reserve has subsidized the banks, and the banks in turn the rest of the business, to the tune of somewhere between $6 and $10 trillion in the U.S. alone. $6 trillion in what they call quantitative easing, buying of assets from private investors in banks and companies, once again, directly buying these assets and probably at above market prices, because the Fed won't tell us what it won't tell Congress what it paid for each of these purchases. It buries it in the annual report. Well, that's a form of subsidization. You know, when the Fed says it has $4.5 trillion on its balance sheet, no, it's over six, because as some of these bonds that were purchased by the Fed have matured and come due, the Fed has just turned around and rebought more. So it looks like there's no additional Fed buying through 2016, but there was. So there's really $6 trillion. $6 trillion of quantitative easing, direct money, liquidity injections to banks and institutions and wealthy investors. And then, of course, there's normal bond buying, open market operations, and so forth over the last 9 years from 2008 to 17. That adds several trillion more of liquidity at low interest rates. Low interest rates. For most of this period, interest rates, the banks were 0.15%. The banks could borrow at barely 0.1%. And then if they borrowed it from the Fed and left it at the Fed would pay them 0.25. So you didn't have to do anything and you make a tenth of a percent. Nice deal. Yeah. So, yeah, we got like $10 trillion of injections by the Fed. And then we have, because interest rates were so low, corporations were just issuing bonds because the interest rate was so dirt cheap, and taking the money raised from issuing bonds and distributing that money as well as their triple profits, 300% profits over the period, to their shareholders in the form of stock buybacks and dividend payouts at the rate of $1 trillion a year, over 6 trillion. So the Fed pumps, 6 to 10 trillion in directly. And then the corporations, because of Fed policies, distribute another 6 trillion. It's 10 to $15 trillion that went to the corporations and their shareholders, one percenters, over the roughly 9 year period. Ah, but monetary policy wasn't the only way the state, and this is what we're talking about, the capitalist state and governments subsidizing business at a rate and level never before seen in history in this country. Direct subsidization. That's what this Fed policy is all about, and that's what the tax policy is also about. Subsidization of capital, of corporations, of investors in the 21st century. You see, when the state is subsidizing you, you don't have to go out and make make money. They'll make it for you. They'll give it to you. Well, what about the fiscal side, the subsidization? Keep in mind we're talking about 10 to $15 trillion because of monetary policy go into corporations and investors and so forth, right? What about fiscal policy? Well, as I've also said, and it's worth repeating on this show, we've got at least as much in fiscal policy, at least $10 trillion in subsidization going on because of tax cuts under Bush, 3.4 trillion, 80% of which studies show went to the wealthiest and their corporations. And then in 2005, Congress, including Democrats, passed this multinational corporation repatriation bill, tax bill, which says to them, okay, you got $700 billion, US multinationals, the Apples, the Techs, the Farmers, and so forth, offshore in your subsidiaries, and you're refusing to bring it back. If you bring it back, instead of paying 35% corporate rate, you can pay 5.25%. And of course, they brought about 350 billion of that 700 billion back in 2005. But they didn't use it to invest in real jobs and expansion in the US. Studies show that 90% of that $350 billion was used to buy back stocks, to pay out dividends, and to merge and acquire competitors. That's what it all went to. And now we got the same thing going on, don't we? Yeah, except it's even more generous. Congress, as part of this tax bill, is saying, okay, corporations, you don't have to pay 35%. If you bring it back, you only have to pay 10 to 12% of what you got there now. And in the future, you don't have to bring anything back because we're getting rid of the territorial tax, you see. Ah, but there's even a loophole there for the 10, 12%, and that is, Only if it's cash. Liquid, in other words. Well, what's going to stop these companies for just, overnight or for a week or a month or two, converting that cash into short-term liquid securities, near liquid securities, to avoid the tax and then convert it back again? That's what they're going to do. They're not going to pay anything. The multinationals are getting away with murder. And they don't pay 35%. Multinational corporations pay about 12 to 15% tax, a couple percent offshore, and a couple percent to the states. So they don't pay more than 15 to 17%, not the 35 to 48%. See, that's just the nominal rate. The effective rate is after all the loopholes. And have you heard of any loophole closing in this bill with Trump? No. No loophole closing. They're going to keep the loopholes and they're going to cut the rates. It's just a blatant redistribution. Oh, they're going to have a big deficit as a result. Yeah, well, they're already talking. Paul Ryan's already talking. Go after Social Security, Medicare, education, etc., right? That's where they're going to make it up. In fact, if the deficit happens, which it will trigger what's called sequestration, which will force them by law to cut. That's the plan, you see. Massive redistribution and subsidization by the state, Congress, the presidency, and the central bank, on the other hand. Well, we're just mentioned under Bush here, 3.4 trillion, 80%, 350 billion multinational corporations in 2005, another 180 billion, 100 billion of that in 2008 as the crisis was unfolding went to consumers, but another 50 billion or so went to businesses and corporations. So you've got $3 to $4 trillion in tax cuts for businesses and investors under Bush. And then Obama comes, $300 billion in 2009. Much of it was for corporations again. An extension of the Bush tax cuts, which was supposed to expire in 2010, he extended them 2 years at a cost of $450 billion a year. And then, because the economy was not really recovering under his minimalist plan, another $803 billion in tax cuts at the end of 2010. And then in 2013, the fiscal cliff deal, he extends the Bush tax cuts another decade. So under Obama, we got about $6 trillion. $3, $4 trillion of tax cuts under Bush, $6 trillion under Obama, that's $10 trillion. You add that fiscal subsidization to the monetary low interest rate QE subsidization and the buybacks and the dividend payouts and the bonds, and what do you get? Oh my God, you got somewhere between 15 and tr 10 20 trillion dollars in subsidization by the state in the form of the central bank monetary policy, at the same time Congress and the presidency fiscal policy, subsidization of businesses and corporations and the rich, the 1%. A massive subsidization going on in this country. And what were the consequences of it? Well, first of all, one consequence, 95% of all net income increase since 2008 has gone to the wealthiest 1% households. 95%, study by Emmanuel Saez, professor of economics, UC Berkeley, ELSA database. That's been going on for 15 years, showing how the amount of 1% keeps increasing. 95%. I mean, under George Bush, it was 65% of all national income went to them, and net national gains. And then under Clinton, it was 45%. So it's been increasing. 45 or 48, excuse me, to 65 to 95. By the way, when I talked about this multinational repatriation boondoggle in 2005 and now occurring once again, it was really made possible by Bill Clinton, you see, because Bill Clinton in 90, 94, 96 said, agreed that corporations and the foreign profits tax didn't have to be paid. All you had to do was check a box. You see, if you're a corporation doing offshore business, check a box that you were going to keep it there. Right? And you could without paying taxes. So, the Democrats are in deep in this thing as well as the Republicans. It's a, they're just two wings of the same corporate party of America, I'm convinced. Two wings of the same. They're not two parties. Oh, when one wants to get back in the driver's seat, they act like it. They throw a few ideas out there, right? But once they get in, it's the same old policies. Okay, so we've got 6 trillion in buybacks, 6 trillion in QE, and about $9 trillion under Obama and Bush in tax cuts. That's how much liquidity, cash, has been thrown at them. Well, where is it all gone? Well, three places, as I've been saying. It's gone into financial asset markets, reinvested in stocks and bonds, derivatives offshore. See, not just in the US, it's invested all over. Derivatives, we don't know because, except for interest rate swaps, there's no market for it. No market public that's not opaque, right? Foreign exchange trading, real property, commercial properties are back up where it is. High-end homes are back up where they were in 2007. So a lot of it's been, all of that distribution has been redistributed and reinvested by in financial markets. And that's why we got the, bond prices records and stock prices records. And now there's so much liquidity, as I've been talking in previous shows and writing on my blog, jackrasmus.com, about bitcoins and cryptocurrencies. There's so much liquidity, they don't know what to do with it. So they create new markets, new financial securities. In other words, they invent a new kind of a gambling scheme at their casino. At their financial casino that they can play with. And that's all bitcoins and cryptocurrencies are. They're not currencies, they're commodities. It's like a it's like gold futures. That's all it is. And in fact, bitcoins are sucking money out of gold investment and going into bitcoins. Well, I don't want to repeat that. That was last week's show. You can listen to it here. My take on the whole Bitcoin phenomenon, which is just a reflection of the speculative shift, speculative financial investing shift that's been going on and now accelerating. And when I say shift, I mean shift from investing in real assets, in other words, plant and equipment and stuff like that, that makes real things, that hires real people, that gives them real wages and income, right? There's been a shift away from that as capitalism globalizes and financializes in the 21st century. The financial structure is changed to accommodate this. New liquid markets are created, new securities, i.e., products to sell in them, are created. These markets are linked up globally, technologically, and a new finance capital elite rises as a result of this and dominates and squeezing out the old bank elites who don't join them. That happens too. And take over the governments. We got government by Goldman Sachs, as I said. They're the ones creating the policies. Goldman Sachs created this tax bill. Who's Gary Cohn? Goldman Sachs. Who's Steve Mnuchin? Goldman Sachs. And they're the ones who crafted this in secret. Six of them, staff helpers here, created this whole abomination called the Trump tax bill, the latest in this handouts to corporations and the rich. Okay, so one of the consequences of this huge redistribution and liquidity income injection, as I said, is to boom financial asset markets everywhere and create this new financial structure that's still developing apace. Another is not all this liquidity created and wealth created for the 1% goes into financial asset markets in the US or abroad. You know, some of it goes into real investment offshore. Right? Offshoring of jobs. That's been going on, you know, for a couple of decades at least, and it's accelerating. I don't care what Trump says about bringing jobs back, it's still accelerating. And of course, free trade gets blamed for that because free trade is a great enabler of this. It enables U.S. corporations to penetrate foreign markets. That's part of the deal. Let the U.S. MNCs, multinational corporations, in you other countries. You know, these free trade deals are about investment flows, not just goods flows, but mostly investment flows on behalf of the U.S. And they're about reducing tariffs and quotas so that U.S. companies who are producing abroad can bring this stuff back to the U.S. market without paying a tariff or a tax. They get the benefit both ways. That's why they love free trade. So a lot of this has gone offshore into real asset investment, but you know, not investment in the U.S. Although if you listen to Trump and Mnuchin and others, they're going to say, oh, you know, it's going to mean big increase in investment in the U.S. Well, answer this then, Mnuchin Trump. If U.S. corporations are sitting on $2 trillion in cash after they've invested in financial markets and after they've invested offshore, they're still sitting on a 2 trillion hoard. Why giving them 4 trillion more is going to make them invest? If they weren't investing with 2 trillion, why giving them 4 trillion more do you think is going to result in investment in real goods and services that produce real jobs? If 2 trillion didn't do it, why would 4 trillion do it? Ah, they're not answering that, are they? And by the way, there's 2.8 trillion stuffed offshore in offshore U.S. corporate subsidiaries. 2.8 trillion as a result of Bill Clinton saying you don't have to pay taxes offshore, as a result of George Bush in 2005 saying if you bring it back, you only have to pay 5.25%. Well, you think after that they wouldn't just build up that offshore hoard again and play that same game, which they're doing? If they got 2.8 trillion offshore and now under the Trump bill, all illusion of having to pay any tax on offshore earnings is eliminated because the territorial tax, as they say, is gone. Any amount of money you make offshore, Apple, right? Or any of your big pharma companies, or any of your big banks, any amount of money you make offshore, you can keep. Now, consider this. If making money offshore, you don't have to pay any tax on anymore. But in the U.S., you have to still pay some, albeit much less, 21% rate, instead of 35% for corporations, right? Don't you think that corporations are going to move even more jobs offshore? Oh, but Trump says he's going to bring the jobs back. Well, any business knows I'm going to move it. If I'm multinational in my operation, I'm going to move my profits offshore. You know, I don't even have to move my physical operations offshore. All I got to do is manipulate intracompany pricing to book my profits offshore by charging my onshore for production higher prices within the company, you see. It's called intracorporate pricing. You manipulate your pricing so your profits appear offshore rather than onshore. They're going to do that. And they're going to pay even less. It's absurd. to think that this bill is going to create jobs. Look, long term, for the last 15 years, real investment has been slowly declining. The rate of growth of real investment has been slowing down. Except for this year, we got a little bit of a boost in business investment, but that's because of buildup of inventories mostly. And when the economy slows down, those inventories are going to disappear. But okay, there's a little bit of what's called the Trump bump going on with business investment. But the long-term trend for 15 years is a dramatic slowing of real investment in the U.S. Well, because they're moving the investment offshore, you see, or they're diverting it into financial markets instead of real investment here. So, given that fact, given the diversion and given the financial investment and given the cash hoard and given the big incentive to move jobs offshore, where are these jobs going to come from that's being promised? And by the way, all this talk about changing free trade, that's a lot of BS too. They're just going to tweak it, you see. All that Trump really cares about free trade is getting a better deal for U.S. corporations, not for U.S. workers. Historic hoard of nearly $5 trillion in cash, offshore and onshore, by U.S. corporations, and investment is slowing down. And if investment is slowing down, then job creation is slowing down, especially high-end job creation, because a lot of this is manufacturing, you see. Which leads us to the next lie, which is all this talk about, gee, why aren't wages rising? They don't understand why wages are rising. You listen to outgoing Fed chair Janet Yellen and her press conferences and the Q&A at her press conferences and so forth, and they're perplexed. Why we aren't getting wage increases is a real conundrum, as they say. Conundrum. That was a term coined by former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan back around 2004-5, when he couldn't understand what was going on with interest rates, why they were so low, and why he couldn't get them up, why long-term rates would not follow short-term rates when he was raising short-term rates, the long-term rates. 10, 20, 30-year rates weren't rising. Scratched his head. He said, well, it's a conundrum. Conundrum simply means I don't understand what the hell's going on. No, he didn't either. And neither does Yellen or any of the other experts today when they say, gee, we got all this stimulus, fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, right? And we have a weak job recovery. Okay, they've created jobs in the last couple of years, but they're part-time, temp, low-paid service jobs. We're churning out high-paid jobs and replacing them with low-paid jobs. And I suspect that a lot of this job numbers are really converting full-time to part-time and counting them because, for unemployment purposes, a part-time job is considered a job created, you see. Well, what's the change? What's to stop businesses from taking a full-time job and replacing it with two part-time jobs? Because you won't have to pay benefits then. You save 25%, you see, on benefits. What's to stop them from doing that? It looks like you're creating more jobs, doesn't it? I think a lot of that is behind these numbers, these job numbers. Well, let's get back to the conundrum. What's the conundrum here? Why is there no wage increase since 2008, or very little? To the extent they have wage increases, it's not in the hourly wage. A lot of it is in the salaried part of the labor force, which is, professionals and managers and so forth. We got about 110 million production and non-supervisory workers Even many of them aren't on hourly. So what are you talking about? You're talking about hourly wages? You're talking about wages more broadly defined? You're talking about weekly earnings, which is wages times the hours worked? Are you talking about all forms of earned pay? And are you including assumptions of small business proprietors, their profits as wages, which we do, you know? U.S. government figures that 65% of small business profits, we call business income, is really wages. 65%, like they're working for themselves. They're like workers for themselves, you know, small business person. Well, that boosts the wage numbers if you define it, including that. And it reduces the income numbers for small businesses. By the way, under this Trump bill, not only will corporations get 1.5 trillion in their corporate tax rate cut from 35 to 21%, not only that, non-corporate businesses will get 700 billion plus in tax cuts through this pass-through provision, reducing it from 39.6 to 25%. And you got to consider when you say business, when you say capitalists, just because they're not the corporate form, they're still capitalists. They're still businesses. They still hire other people. They still make profits, even though we call it business income. It's really profits. You got to count that. And then you got to count the interest income for banks and the rental income and the lease income. These are all should be added together. But we conveniently exclude that from, quote, corporate profits. So corporate profits are even bigger than they actually are. Business profits, let's say. Much bigger. Okay, so one of the reasons I think that we're not getting the wage increases is this shift from full-time jobs to contingent jobs. Contingent meaning part-time, temp, on-call, contract, gig, etc. Even today, young people are working for nothing in order to just prove to an employer, particularly in the tech industry, this is going on, that they should be hired. Yeah, they work for nothing. That's how desperate it's become. Unheard of in previous decades. And unheard of that the government would even allow that. You know, that's just exploitation, 100% exploitation. But they're desperate for a job. Young people coming out of college and want to get into tech because that's the only area you can make any money. You know, the rest of it is just disappearing. Part-time, insecure, no benefits, etc. So they work for nothing. Okay, so that's contingency. If you take regular full-time jobs that we used to have and you convert them to contingent jobs, they're all lower paid and fewer hours worked. So if your definition of wages is weekly earnings, it's even lower, you see. And then we are continuing to offshore jobs. And as I said, this new bill will offshore even more. High wage, mostly going offshore. That's another reason why there's no growth. If you take high wages offshore, it lowers the average in the US. If you take higher full-time paid jobs, convert them contingent, which are part-time, lower paid, fewer hours, you convert them to a lower wage. But that's not all, you see. It used to be when there was a recovery period, the unions would step in and recoup what had been lost during the recession. Well, there's no unions anymore to speak of, just in the public sector and a few transport unions here and there. They've been destroyed, devastated, what's left of them, tripping over themselves to be cooperative with their employers. So, no unions to lead the wage recovery as there used to be in the business cycle. And a slower lagging adjustment in minimum wages, which affect 20 million workers. If you don't adjust the minimum wage, you know, about 10 million or so on minimum wage, and the group right above them affected by whatever minimum wage is. So that's 20 million people of a 166 million labor force. Not an insignificant number. Okay, that's not being adjusted the way it used to be. So no unions, no minimum wage. And then we got this productivity stagnation. You see, if productivity is rising, employers, all things equal, will be more amenable to giving wage increases to their workers. But if productivity is not rising, you know, if it's stagnant or falling, that means business union labor costs are rising, and they take it out on wages by either not giving wage increases or giving less wage increases or even cutting wages. So the productivity stagnation is also what's going on. And just like real investment has been slowing down the rate of growth, so is productivity. Productivity now, you know, 1% maybe in the last few years. Or less, a half percent. It hit a half percent there at one point. And if you have no productivity and no wage recovery and poor, lower paid jobs, well, how do people, households, the 110 million, middle class and below, maintain consumption? Because consumption seems to be maintained, it's getting weaker in a number of areas. Autos are down and so forth. But, you know, you're talking about the consumption still holding. Well, it's because people are taking money out of their savings and taking on debt. The U.S. household savings right now is barely 3%. Used to be 10. It's barely 3. And what about household debt? It's right back where it was in 2007, right on the eve of the last crisis. And you know, the greater level of debt you have, greater level of debt, when you lose your job, the bigger the crisis on the consumption side. The debt overhang, the more defaults. And the more defaults by consumers, well, then businesses eventually have to default too, because they go under. Okay, so, you know, the result of the 10-year plus of the real investment slowdown, productivity stagnation, wage stagnation, decline in savings rate, household savings rate, and rise in household debt levels. And they say the US economy is doing well? No way. All this was talked about in my book, Systemic Fragility at the Global in the Global Economy, looking at labor markets and financial markets and structures and policies and so forth, and in which I developed my own theory of financial instability. And based on that, predicting, you know, when the next financial crisis will occur. Well, I'm going to, for those interested, I'm going to, serialize the final chapter, Theory of Financial Stability Instability, on my website, which is kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. But you can get to it easier if you don't remember that from my blog, jackrasmus.com. Just click on the blog role or the role on the side. It'll take you right to the website. And under articles, I'll be serializing that final chapter, which I wrote in January 2016, not that long ago, because we're getting more financially fragile, no doubt. All the bubbles are all signals, all signs that this is beginning to happen. It'll take some time yet, you know, 12 to 18 months, as I predict, but we're on the same track we were. And it won't be subprime mortgages and housing, it will come in another form. You know, when we had the crash in 2008, it was driven by the housing bubble and the subprime mortgages that drove that bubble, and the converting of subprime mortgages into derivative products, and then credit default swaps at the end of that that thread of derivative creation. And when Lehman Brothers investment bank, shadow bank, went under in September, AIG, the big investment, I mean, insurance company, also shadow bank, insurance companies are shadow banks, had written all these credit default swaps on Lehman, far more than they could pay off, because they thought they would never have to pay them off. And when Lehman crashed, AIG was about to crash until the government bought it out. And then after it subsidized AIG to the tune of a couple hundred billion dollars, it let it go private again. You see, that's what capitalist nationalizations are. They bail out the banks, and sometimes they even nationalize them, particularly in Europe. And then they use the taxpayer to refloat them, and then they sell them off real cheap once again to private capitalists and bankers. You see, it's just another form of subsidy. And that's what happened with AIG. Well, what do we got now? Well, what's the combination? Certainly derivatives will be involved, but not CDSs. It'll be a new form of derivative, and I think the new form of derivative is going to be exchange traded funds, ETFs, that are taking over stocks and bonds and so forth, helping to drive up the market, equity markets and bond markets. Okay. And now we got cryptocurrencies and bitcoins, and they're now being sold on commodity exchanges, the CBOE and CME in Chicago. In other words, they've legitimized these cryptocurrencies, digital currencies, well, actually cryptocurrencies. See, these are cryptocurrencies, which is a form of digital currency. Central banks will issue their own digital currencies eventually to try to head off the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and so forth, but it'll be too late by the time they do that. But anyway, we got a legitimation here of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and that's what sent, when it was clear this is happening, it would be traded in futures and options on them would now be traded. When this was clear a couple months ago, that's when Bitcoin prices started going through the roof, because now it was going mainstream. You see, capitalists have found, oh, here's another financial asset market for our casino. We can add a new table to our casino. We'll call this, the crypto table. We have an equities table and commodities futures and oils futures table, and all these other derivatives tables, kind of analogous to your crap tables and your roulette tables and baccarat tables and so forth. They got their own tables here, and they're creating new tables. And Bitcoin, cryptos are a new table. Going to be interesting here. Well, what's the new combo here? Could it be cryptos and ETF derivatives? When the cryptos collapse, drag down, if they allow ETFs for bitcoins, which they will and are talking about and working towards, they've even tried to get it approved. The Winklevosses, Winklevosses. Remember those from Facebook fame? That movie, Facebook, right? The Zuckerberg outmaneuvers the Winklevosses, Boston, Massachusetts billionaires, right? Steals Facebook from them. Well, they're off into bitcoins, And they've already applied for an ETF for bitcoins, see? And we'll see whether they get approved. If there's a lot of money to be made for mainline capitalists, it will. I've recently wrote a piece, by the way, that will appear in the European Financial Review called Financial Assets and Bubbles and Bitcoin. A more provocative version of which is now on my blog and has appeared on Counterpunch and Telesur and other places, other public blogs called, Are Bitcoins the New Subprime Mortgage Bomb? Well, you can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can go to those sources and read it. A little more speculative thinking out of the box there. than in the mainstream European Financial Review. But I will publish the Financial Review piece here when it appears later in the month. Also, by the way, a review of my Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope book will appear by Dr. Larry Souza. You can already read some reviews of that, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, because all of this speculative excess liquidity is made possible by the central banks. Ever since the collapse of the Bretton Woods international monetary system based on dollar pegged to gold in the 1970s, the central banks have been running amok, printing money electronically, whatever, issuing excess liquidity. And it's that mass mountain of excess liquidity begins under Greenspan in the 80s, continues under Bernanke, continues under Yellen, that is responsible for this huge injection of liquidity, more than can even be invested in real assets, even offshore. So it goes into financial assets and it goes into hoarding. And that's the big change, a big change in the nature of capitalism in the 21st century. You know, that's what we call financialization, or at least what I call financialization. It's this whole new financial structure that's been created. You know, it's not the banks earning more profits than non-banks. You know, has to do with the entire financial system globally and shadow banks. And new financial asset markets, highly liquid markets, and the new securities that are created, and the agents behind it, which are the new finance capital elites, which very few people were talking about. Who are these people? You know, how are they restructuring the global economy in the 21st century? How are they penetrating the governments to ensure the policies that they want, which they're doing? Because this is where the big profits and the big returns have focused. You know, it's not the JP Morgans. It's the shadow banks. That's their preferred institutions because they're unregulated. And they can do what they want with them. Okay, so let's get back to the wage conundrum here. Haven't quite finished that. All right, we talked about wages are low because of the shift from full-time to contingency, from the shift to offshoring of high-paid jobs, from the destruction of union power, from the lagging adjustment of federal minimum wage, from the stagnation of productivity, which is a reflection of the shift to financial assets from real investing. Also, the rising costs of benefits, health care in particular. Retirement, they've already destroyed, you know, when they converted from defined benefit pensions to 401ks. And of course, retirement is being destroyed with the absorption of the savings rates. But with rising costs to health care, businesses, to the extent that they have to pay and are paying for higher health care costs, they give less wage increases. That's another reason why wages have not risen. And they got another solution to that, of course. Instead of paying wage increases, you just privatize the whole healthcare system. And that's what Obamacare is. It's a privatization. And it's a direct descendant of George Bush's health savings accounts. And that's a descendant of Bill Clinton's managed care. You see, they've been moving towards privatization for some time. They privatized pension benefits in under Reagan in the 80s and 90s, and now they've been working on privatizing, meaning you go buy your own. Right? Corporations don't have to carry that cost. Well, under Obamacare, you know, there was like a transition. The employers had a mandate. See, they had to pay employees. They didn't have to provide the insurance, but they had to pay this mandate to sell health. To partially offset the cost of the subsidization when people buy health care insurance under Obamacare, which is really a pass-through to the health insurance companies. Okay, so they have to pay this this mandate. Well, that's a temporary holding pattern, you see, and now they're getting rid of the mandate. So it's going to be pure privatization now, without any skin in the game for businesses. Ah, they knew this would happen this way. Eventually, they'd do it, but they didn't think they'd get away with it so quick until Trump comes in. So he's accelerating it. Okay, but and then we even have the wage conundrum. We got to talk about real wages, not nominal wages. Real wages are even lower than nominal because the government grossly underestimates inflation and price increases for the middle class. Clearly, the cost of rents and medical insurance and education and state and local taxes and fees and so forth is greater for the middle class than 1.8% per year. Now it was 1 point, it was 1%. You tell me all those increases, if you're middle class, if you're $45,000 to $50,000 annual income, then your cost of living has only increased 1%. What is that? $500? Yeah. $500 a year, that's all that prices have gone up for you? $500 a year? Hell, you paid that much more for gas, let alone all the other costs, or food, let alone all the other costs. They're telling you it's only risen $500 per year. Does anybody believe that? If you do, I got a bridge that I want to sell you. No, real wages have at least stagnated and probably declined. And the lower you go in the income level below the median of the middle class, the more that is. Well, the wage conundrum is not difficult to understand, but if you listen to Janet Yellen in a press conference, gee, I don't understand what's going on there. Another thing about Janet Yellen's press conference this week that was interesting, just show you how confused these people are, right? She says that, GDP, the economic growth, next year is going to be 2.5%, and in 2019 as well, 2.5%. And therefore, the federal funds rate is going to rise to 2.1% next year, 2.7 in 19, and 3.1 in 2020. Now, I've said in my Central Bankers at the End of the Rope that they can't raise interest rates that way. It will provoke a credit crunch and a recession. And I predicted that no more than 1% more in the federal funds rate can be absorbed without a credit crisis. All right, we're at what, 1.25, 1.5? So if we got 2.5 in the federal funds rate, that's it. Here comes your recession. All right, that's my prediction anyway. The Fed says in his press conference, Janet says that three more increases next year, well, that's going to put us well over 2%. A reflection in the longer run interest rates, the bond rates, comparable to this 2% would be if the 10-year bond reached 3% or more, 3.5% in that vicinity. 10-year bond rate, that's a long-term rate. If it follows the short-term rates up, then that's another indicator. And what we see, by the way, is a steady increase in what's called the yield curve. The yield curve is the difference, the spread between 2-year, 10-year bonds or 10-year and 30-year bonds, right? And it's down to about a half a percent, or what they say is 50 basis points. It's been declining since 2012, 13, very steadily. Now, the yield curve is a predictor of recessions. And when that yield curve inverts, in other words, short-term rates are higher than long-term rates, you always get a recession. Always. It's the best, one of the best indicators of recession. And we're only less than a half a percent spread from that inversion. And if you look at what's going on today, with the rates, big increases in short-term rates and declines in long-term rates. So the inversion is coming. The yield curve is going to invert next year sometime if the Fed keeps raising those rates another percent next year, as they said they would. And that's another harbinger of my prediction of recession in late 18, early 19. You know, if you look at Janet here, she says we're going to have this growth justifying higher rates, but it doesn't look like inflation's going to rise. And therefore, it doesn't look like wage inflation, wage increases are going to rise. That's the conundrum, right? But prices for goods and services aren't going to rise. Well, how does she say that? You know, if GDP is rising and economic growth is rising and taking off, but prices aren't going to rise? Well, that's a contradiction, right? And by the way, she says that contrary to the trumpet, that the tax cut's going to have minimal effect. They all know it's going to have minimal effect. And you know, when Trump says, oh, we're going to get a 4% growth rate, everybody laughs through their teeth, right? Okay. And this is what all the economists are commenting on after Janet's press conference. You know, how do we get that, right? How do we get that GDP growth and still no price increase? You know, that's supposed to be the target, 2%. By the Fed, and we never reached the 2% because the 2% was never a target. You know, that's just a phony target to justify pumping more money into investors, into their corporations, and into the 1%. And they're going to continue this policy. As I've said, I don't think they're going to raise. They can't raise it. If they do, it'll be one of the biggest historical errors and policy change they've ever done. And the fact that she said nothing about selling off the balance sheet here in her last meeting is an indication they're not really serious. And you look at what happened here with the European Central Bank, even though you got growth going in Europe, you know, what did Mario Draghi, the chair of the ECB, say? Oh, we're going to continue putting money into the system. You see, all this talk about wage targets, interest rate targets, you know, price targets, all that. It's phony. It's all about subsidizing the system, which needs a subsidization as it never has before. It either needs it or it can get it, so it wants it. It's getting away with it, so why not? You know, why not more? I don't know. I haven't made up my mind whether, you know, capitalism requires this subsidization or whether they've just gotten more greedy than ever before. Okay, so that's it on taxes. We'll have a much more detailed account of the Trump tax bill next week. $4 trillion handout.